Hey everybody, this is Random Chatterings episode 37.5. I'm Marlo Rodriguez and my special guest today is...
Michael Suglio. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Great.
All right. Well, Mike, tell everybody where you're from.
I originally grew up in Mentor, as we call it, Ohio. And then about 4 years ago, I finally moved closer to Case Western Reserve University. And I currently live in the Little Italy community in part of the University Circle.
Very nice. So what is your occupation, Mr. Suglio?
Ooh, I have a lot of ragtag jobs here, but my main occupations are I'm an adjunct faculty at Cleveland State University in the Department of Communications, and I instruct TV and film production one, so I guess I technically am a film professor.
Oh, excellent.
Yes. I also run the Short Suite Film Festival.
Yes.
And then I do a lot of freelance film jobs, so that's kind of what I do outside of a lot of service industry jobs here and there.
Very nice. How did the Short Suite Film Festival get started?
Very good question. So basically about... about 5 years ago now. A friend of mine were at a bar in Cleveland called Now That's Class, and we were there. I haven't been there since the inception of the story here, we were there, and a friend of ours was at the time dating one of this lead singer of this band. And so we were there to support the band, support her, and she was on stage for a bit. And I noticed in the audience it was is comprised of other musicians. And so my friend, who actually helped start the Short Suite Film Fest, Alex Pavlov, suggested, you know, he's like, do you have anything like this in your film community? You know, do filmmakers kind of rally behind other local Cleveland filmmakers? I said yes and no. You know, there's a few film festivals. There's Cleveland International Film Festival, which is an excellent film festival, but it's rather large, and they only have so many slots for local programming. So he suggested that, you know, him and I really start spearheading very short, hence the name Short Suite, and, you know, locally based film festival that really showcases the talent of up-and-coming local filmmakers, you know, artists, what have you, as well as we do showcase a lot of student films as well.
How long has the film festival been going for?
So we first came up with this idea late, winter of 2011, and then the first festival was in June of 2012. So we've had five festivals in four calendar years.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. I understand that you have made some documentaries before.
I have made some documentaries. My first documentary that kind of jump started, I guess, my career in filmmaking was called The Struggle for Existence, and it juxtaposed the Creation Museum in Cincinnati and the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, and how they approach not only science, but also education as well. So at that time, this is 2007, my team was definitely one of the first teams to go into the Creation Museum and really, really interview a lot of the main players, a part of that organization. And then we showed the film at a decent amount of festivals across the country, and then my most recent documentary, which is now about two years old now, called A Tribute to the Fallen, which is shot on location in Negros Oriental, Philippines.
That's right. Yeah, I remember you working on that.
Yeah. So it's done, and it's gone to a decent amount of festivals, and it's basically about this gentleman, Felix Constantino El Catal, and Felix has spent the past 50 years of his life just digging in the dirt. That's, he has obviously a job, and he's actually an accountant. But he, all of his free time, he's spent digging at different battleground locations in the Philippines, battlegrounds for World War II.
Yeah.
Where there's still a lot of artifacts, and he likes to call them relics, but a lot of, you know, pieces of history and still buried in the ground. And he's also uncovered 28 Japanese soldiers that have, you know, never been, their bodies have never been sent home. And he actually knows seven more, but he physically can't get them. He's waiting for the Japanese embassy to kind of come in. So the documentary kind of explores his life and what he does, and then it kind of dives into the fact that everything he, all of his digging and stuff is surrounded by bombs.
Oh my God!
And so, like halfway through the film, I kind of go off on a tangent. We basically, he just goes, well, by the way, there's loaded bombs that are still alive. And he talks about how he disarms the bombs so he can continue.
Wow.
Digging. It's kind of, every time I watch the film, it really changes the flow of the film, because it's just like, oh yeah, by the way, there are bombs everywhere that I've been digging for the past 50 years. So
did he need to get a permit to get this
done?
He just started doing it.
This is the Philippines, not the United States. You know, there's really very little rules. I mean, there's definitely no alcohol rules. You could definitely have open container. There's no such thing as permits, really, either. So you just, you don't want to be digging up somebody else's yard. But this is just, free land. It's a lesson to be learned, as, in the United States, all land is owned by someone or something. Whereas in the Philippines, there's still some, final frontier. There's still some, unclaimed, uncharted territory, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. How did you find out about I'm sorry, I forgot his name.
Felix?
Felix. How did you find out about this crazy endeavor of his?
Sure. So the way we found Felix was, while I was in the Philippines, I wanted to try to secure some World War II artifacts, because they're quite plentiful and probably one of the last parts of the world where you could easily attain World War II artifacts, because people forget that the U.S. had such a huge presence in the Pacific Theater in the Philippines. I mean, basically, from what I've gathered, and I explore this in the documentary, is the Japanese at the time were enslaving the Filipinos, and the whole idea that they would become like the worker bees of the new, I guess, republic. And so what happened was, when the U.S. was coming in and bombing, a lot of the Pacific Islands, they also just came into the Philippines and defeated the Japanese, who were basically creating, camps no different than, camps you would have seen in Germany with Auschwitz,
Right.
So they weren't necessarily trying, they were definitely executing and, extinguishing a lot of the Filipinos, but they were also preparing them to become factory workers and test subjects on whatever crazy science, no different than the Germans. And so while I was there, I wanted to try to grab some, World War II helmets and whatever. So I asked around, and they says, well, we know a guy who who has dedicated his life towards this. And Felix, one thing I forgot to mention is, Felix has his house and his garage is filled with what he's dug up over the past 50 years, and it's easily one of the most extensive World War II memorabilia collections I have ever seen in my life. It's on par, if not above and beyond, the Smithsonian. It's unreal. I mean, one of the things that stands out in my mind that we talk about in the documentary is, Felix's most prized possessions of his finds are unopened medicinal bottles. So, he has, unopened bottles of morphine. You're never going to see, glass bottles that were not used in World War II. They just don't exist anymore. Right. And he has a collection of this. So he might be the only person in the world that has these artifacts, which is unreal.
Does he... I mean, I imagine he probably has, very secure, ways of... preserving this.
Yes and no. I mean,
yes and no.
There's, you know, it's again, it's in the Philippines. It's a third world nation. There's only, you know, so many ways you could preserve stuff. So things are in glass and they're in a garage. The garage is not even air conditioned. And, you know, he doesn't have it, you know, that secure because everyone knows who he is. And, like, if someone was to break in and try to steal any of this stuff, you know, what are they going to do with it? You know, if they try to sell it immediately, they're going to know, oh, yeah, there's this one guy on this island that has all this stuff. I wonder who this stuff belongs to. And you know, in the Philippines, they're very much a Catholic Christian nation, and they have no remorse for wrongdoing. So if anyone did it and they were caught, you're looking at, you know, you're immediately sent to jail for a long, long time.
Oh, my God.
And the jails in the Philippines are unreal. They're unbelievably terrible. They're like, you know, medieval dungeons, you know.
Oh,
and
God.
So, you know, no one's going to steal from them. No one's dumb enough to do that, you know.
You have any interest in returning to the Philippines, like maybe like for follow-up?
I've thought about that. You know, one of the reasons why I went to the Philippines is for two reasons. Is one, it's incredibly cheap to get there, and mm-hmm. once you're there, it's rather cheap. But two is it's one of the few countries left in the world that's unbelievably in love with the U.S. still. So it's a great place to go. I mean, I would like to save my money to see other parts of the world.
Absolutely.
However, I definitely would like to go back to the Philippines within the next few years and follow up with Felix and tell him, hey, by the way, you know, a film about you has been shown, you know, in many different places in the United States, you know, and that just blows his mind. You know, he never would expect that or assume that would ever happen. So.
Yeah. How old is Felix?
Felix is 55.
55.
So now, he's 55 when I met him, so now he's 58 at this point. Mm-hmm. So he's, you know, he's not an old man, so he's got a few years, you know. And he has a good family and a good support system there, and his family's pretty well off compared to most of the places in the Philippines.
Right.
So he's doing fine, and you know, I'll definitely want to you know, rekindle with him at some point in the next 5 years.
Definitely.
I'd
say. I want to ask you a few more questions about your experience with documentary filmmaking in general, but I just like to switch back to the struggle. The struggle for change.
Struggle for existence.
The struggle for existence.
Charles Darwin term. Good old Chuck.
And ask what were the challenges in creating that documentary, especially
Ooh.
Since you was that your thesis project?
Kind of. Yeah, it kind of was like a thesis project for my undergrad. The struggle for existence, the number one challenge was convincing people that you're not fraudulent. which is kind of funny, actually.
Oh my God.
One of the key things is like the Creation Museum is in its own thing, and the Cleveland Museum of Natural History is its own thing.
Right, absolutely.
And both camps pretty much despise each other, and so you know it's like, you know, trying to get the Hatfields and the McCoys together. But the thing is, they were both incredibly skeptical because they thought I was, you know, a spy for the other camp.
Yeah.
Which was absolutely ridiculous. I just wanted to make a film. So that was the thing that was the biggest challenge. And then, you know, afterwards, the one of the participants in the film did not like the outcome of the film and, you know, really caused a stir.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very unfortunate. But he has left the organization, is no longer in Ohio, because I was quite terrified to run into him because he was quite vocal. But that's the thing, is like whenever you make documentary films, you're never going to make everyone happy, and there's
Absolutely.
Always going to be people against you. I mean, that's the thing, is any art you produce, you know, no matter what you produce, 100% of the people who view it aren't going to be like, I love this. This is my favorite thing ever. That's the greatest painting ever. Forget Mona Lisa. Yours is great. Yeah, so that's the thing is there's always going to be critics. And so
absolutely.
You just have to just go with it because, you know, for every few critics, there's still, you know, the people who enjoy your art, at least if you do good art, like I like to think I do, will always outweigh the you know, negative critics.
Definitely. When you were making, because you were making this film as a student, I imagine your objective was to be objective with
correct
the presentation.
Yeah. Right.
What was it, not even referring to that particular person, but I guess what were some things that other people might, who watched the documentary might think could be subjective?
Mm. So one of the things that was interesting was a lot of people thought just by having the Creation Museum in the film, it was immediately subjective because they thought they were immediately subjective. And so that's totally a valid argument.
Yeah.
But the film was about the juxtaposition of the two, so hence that was not a valid argument. And then what was quite humorous was people thought one museum got more time than the other museum, and then literally what I did was I literally spent, oh my gosh, I spent probably a whole day doing this, counting the time of each argument. And actually, I said, you know what, is actually the other argument actually has a good, like, 2 minutes more than the other one, which I thought was quite humorous.
Yeah, that reminds me of, like, the negotiations between, like, Warner Brothers and Disney to include the characters, and that they have to be in the film for the exact same time.
Right.
Not 1 second more than the other person, the other character.
Right. That's crazy. Was that Who Framed Roger Rabbit you're referencing?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that was pretty ridiculous. But yeah, it's I obviously remain objective, and the film is incredibly objective. And you know, I would say at this point, outside of the one negative critic of the film, everyone who sees it usually agrees that it's incredibly objective. Again, you can't please everyone.
Absolutely. What are you thinking about? Since you've said it's been 2 years since your last project, what is the next project that you want to do?
It's funny. It's right before I came here, I had a meeting about the next project.
Very
so,
nice. Oh, yeah, very
it's,
nice.
That's kind of funny. So I'm currently working on a film about Cleveland's brewing
ooh,
beer.
And you're perfect for that because you haven't.
Because you like to drink. You're perfect.
That's not what I meant. I do not want to misrepresent this man. I am saying that you have an article for our college newspaper where you review several bars and places like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I do so I do a lot of brewery research. I find in articles, or I guess brewery journalism. I kind of created this. I just find it very fascinating to learn where what you're drinking comes from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I try not to eat too much fast food or store-bought things. You know, I try to get, like, actual just, like, raw materials and make food, you know. And,
yeah, definitely.
So I was quite interested in to find, you know, where this beer that I drink comes from. So I started, you know, learning about different breweries, and then they kind of escalated to this project here, which I'm, you know, trying to get out of the stages of pre-production and go to production at this point.
I guess what are the legal things that you have to take care of before you can start filming?
No, not really legal things. It's because, I mean, whenever you make a film, you immediately own all the intellectual property. It's funding, obviously. You know, that's one of the big things. You know,
yeah.
Yeah, nothing is no art is done, you know, with zero budget. So everything it costs some money to produce anything, really.
That's true. So what inspired you to do, maybe not exclusively, but for now, like, your most well known works have been documentaries.
Mm.
Where did that transition happen from doing, like, trying to do narrative filmmaking to documentary filmmaking?
That's a very good question. So I do like making narrative fictional films. I actually do write a lot of scripts. To do a documentary, it's, in my opinion, easier because one, you could definitely get funding a lot easier than you could do for a fictional piece because usually you're doing some sort of cause or some sort of lesson or some sort of education. But with documentaries, it's the costs are also a lot lower because your characters are real human beings. They're not actors, and so you're not paying them and you're not scripting them. And the nice thing about documentaries is it could be a little ragtag as well, whereas with, you know, a fictional piece, it has to be crystal clear. Obviously, you don't want a terrible picture or sound, but it doesn't necessarily have to be as clean and pristine as if you were doing a fictional piece.
That's true.
Plus, also, I mean, I like documentaries because I feel like you're actually, like, you're doing a little bit more to add to the value of, you know, not only yourself, but the viewer. I mean, it's definitely, I appreciate the education process of nonfiction film. I mean, maybe it's just the instructor in me, but I do like, you know, people walking away from something I've done and go, wow, I learned something about this. This added value to my existence. But no, I really do love fiction. I probably enjoy making fiction more than nonfiction. It's just in the long run, it's definitely more rewarding for me to do nonfiction.
What are some of the, I guess when you think about writing a script, what's your process like? Like, what is it that you're trying to do, or is it mostly just I'm just want to write something that no one else has really written before?
Oh, is this for fiction or nonfiction?
For fiction.
Oh, well, it's not necessarily doing something that no one else has done. It's doing something that's meaningful to you. Okay. So like, I mean, I think the thing is like you always have to immediately understand what is the human side of things and like how is it connected to you, because that's really important. You know, you have to immediately know what's the story, what's the beginning, middle, and end. I teach that in my classes. The golden rule is, you know, everything has a beginning, middle, and end in life. And so I start coming up with stories in my head, and then I immediately say, well, okay, how can I got to sit down and establish what is the beginning, what is the middle, and what's the end, or I'm not going to continue writing. Because, like, sure, you can do stream of consciousness to some extent with writing, and some of that is the best writing. But if you don't have a map of what you're doing, it can easily just go into just silliness, you know? Like,
yeah,
you know, sometimes I'll do some writing, and then suddenly it like, escalates into some crazy gunfight, you know? And, like, I'm just like, how did it get to this? It started as a romantic comedy, and now someone was actually a secret agent the whole time. This happened to my last fictional film, which actually came out great after I got rid of the gunfight, obviously. But, you know, that was the thing, is I didn't necessarily plan out the beginning, middle, and end, and so I really tried to do that. You know, I really tried to create an outline, a sketch. You know, I storyboard. I do all the tricks of the craft, you know. And without that, you end up just going into nonsense. You really do.
Have you heard the story of, I think Lucy K said it on Marc Maron, but he said has the story about a girl who grows a mustache, but he actually created the entire scenario for this movie.
About someone, a girl growing a mustache?
Yeah.
Oh, so it was a full feature?
He never made the movie, but he just wrote up the entire scenario. Like, he knows exactly what happens in the entire movie.
Right, and that's what you would do. Yeah, that's how you would make a film, so write a script. Except for, like, TV shows are a little different. So TV shows, it's a full beginning, middle, and end each episode that adds up to a whole beginning, middle, and end for the season, and then a whole beginning, middle, and end for the series. So it's a little bit different. Where with TV shows, you'll have a pilot that usually sits around for a few years until somebody picks it up, And then, you know, they'll give the order for a few episodes. You plan those out and maybe they'll give the order for a few more. But,
right.
You know, really for a TV show, going at the start of production, they might have 1, 2, 3 episodes. But really no more than that, actually. So yeah. That's not necessarily as planned out as writing a feature or even a short.
Yeah, that kind of, I don't know. I don't know if maybe this might not be similar, but I feel like novel writing, it feels like there's definitely, because there's so many other elements that have to be considered, I feel like that's similar to how someone has to plot an entire season compared to like a movie.
Yeah, but for a novel, they've definitely planned out how the novel's going to go. They know the beginning, middle, and end from the start. I would hope they would. Unlike a TV show. I mean, like, for example, I know George R. R. Martin for Game of Thrones had plotted out the outline for his book that's allegedly coming out in August.
Oh, wow.
And from that outline is what they helped use to create season 6. Mm-hmm. Of Game of Thrones. So I know, at least for a novel, he plotted that out, whereas, like I said, with the TV shows, they didn't necessarily do that. Because also with TV shows, it's like, you know, there's people that are coming and going, and it's a different director for each episode, usually.
That's right, yeah.
Even though they have the main showrunner. And so also it's like, with a TV show, if there's like a personality, you know, behind the scenes that's a cancer to the show, then they'll just kill that character off, and that could change everything, you know? So it's different because, like, they're going to have to deal with this person for, you know, years, whereas with a movie, it's like, well, once it's done. I don't have to necessarily see you again.
That's true, yeah. Speaking of movies, what is your favorite movie of all time? Or top five, if you want to.
Oh, well, I have top five. I don't know if I could do top five off the top of my head. My two favorite films, and I like them for different reasons. My favorite film is Cinema Paradiso. It's an Italian film, 1989, actually. That's just a great film, and it's a good film about, you know, this guy, coming-of-age story about this guy who becomes a filmmaker. It's kind of inspiring, and I'm Italian. That film just really connected with me. But then my favorite film experience, which is a whole nother thing, but also it's a great film,
Absolutely.
Is Jurassic Park. Yeah, I remember watching that as a kid in the theater with my grandfather and father. And, you know, still, every time you rewatch Jurassic Park, it's just such an experience because you look back at the CGI at the time and the story and the John Williams score. You know, it's just a good, epic summer blockbuster, which you do see nowadays, but it doesn't have that magicalness as it did back in the 90s, because now, you know, that was such a groundbreaking film. Now you see CGI dinosaurs or whatever all the time, basically.
There was a whole movie filled with, like, CG dinosaurs. Like, Jurassic World was that, basically.
Right, right. Well, I mean, that's also the, you know, the fourth film of the series. I would hope there'd be CGI dinosaurs. You would think maybe by the fourth film they actually learned how to make these dinosaurs and they could just have them. But the science isn't fast enough to catch up with these movies.
I feel like a lot of people usually harken back and they say, like, remember when CG was, like, really... Well, I mean, there was, like, a lot of great tricks, like, practical effect tricks in Jurassic Park that made all the elements combine together. And it is something that I don't really get a chance. Like, I haven't seen a movie recently that really, like, harkens back to that. Just, like, experience. Like, just the experience of watching a film and just having that be the encapsulating aspect of the entire,
thing. Right. So now everything's kind of, like, obviously plot-driven because we've seen the CGI before. I don't know. When I saw the most recent Mad Max, I was pretty impressed.
My God. I'm going to see that. Everyone in the world, I am going to see it. I'm going to see it.
Well, the cinematography is pretty fantastic, and that kind of had me have the same effects as when I first watched Jurassic Park. So it's a pretty brilliant film. You should see it.
Mr. Suglo, thank you for very much for coming on the show.
Sure, thank you. This was fun.
All right. Where can people find you? If people wanted to buy your documentaries or see your documentaries, where could they do that?
You can buy The Struggle for Existence online at thestruggleforexistence.com. You could get it there actually. It used to be at Barnes & Noble, but I think like I sold out all those copies and I just never replenished it. but yeah, you can get it online. The other films I was thinking recently of throwing them just on YouTube. Because they're just shorts.
Mm-hmm.
But you could definitely, if you would like to, buy the feature. Again, that's thestruggleforexistence.com.
Excellent. All right, well, thank you very much for coming on the show.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, this has been Random Chatterings. Thanks for listening, everybody.